everybody, and welcome to another True Stories of Tinseltown. And yes, the world is weird and scary and frightening. And today I have a wonderful guest for you, and her name is Sloane DeForest. She's wonderful. She was on before. We were talking about the greatest sci-fi flicks, and you'll love this book. And Sloane is actually the one who thought of doing the subject. So hi, Sloane, and why don't you tell everybody what we're doing?
Hi, Grace. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
You're there in Ground Zero, can we say, in New York City?
Yes.
I'm here in Los Angeles, which is not as big of an outbreak, but also a hot spot, and we are holed up.
Yes.
And we're watching movies. About the movies that I thought would be fun to talk about are ones that are where the characters really survive severe hardship, deprivation, and they're able to come out of it on the other side.
And we chose, although it took us a while, we went back and forth with our decisions, but I think you're going to like the 10 we picked. Just like last week with John DeLeo, we did different ones. We did like ones that will make you feel good. No deprivation. They just kind of start off great and end great. So that's what we did. This is the difference with what
nice
Sloane
too.
And I are doing, you know? We're doing, because we are going through, all of us are going through great time like we never had before in our life, ever. We haven't seen the likes of this, and I don't think any of us were born in 1918. And, you know, this is all new for all of us. So I think Sloane's idea was great. Immediately I said, Eureka, terrific, let's do it. And so, Sloane, would you like to tell us your first choice?
I would love to kick things off with Jane Eyre from 1943, directed by Robert Stevenson. Now, there have been many versions of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, but this is the one I think you and I were talking, and we both agree, kind of, we like this one the best. It's difficult. Jane Eyre is one of my favorite novels, and it's a really difficult one to capture on film. It's long, and it covers kind of the course of her life almost, or the first 10 chapters really are her childhood. Now, in the film version, with Joan Fontaine, Orson Welles, of course, and then young Jane is played by the lovely Peggy Ann Garner, who does a great job.
The amazing child actress. Oh.
Yeah, she was really good. I mean, she was even affecting, you know, a passable British accent,
yes,
you know, English accent in this film, right? And she's an American actress. So she was amazing. But, you know, there's been no film version that doesn't truncate her the book in the sense that the first 10 chapters take place in, you know, in her childhood, where she's very mistreated. She lives with her terrible aunt and cousins who abuse her. It's sort of set the stage for Harry Potter. It's very Dickensian as well. And then she's sent to Lowood Institution, which is run by a harsh taskmaster, Mr. Brocklehurst, who
played by perfection by Henry Daniels.
Henry Daniels. Yes. Oh, he's the man you love to hate, right?
Yes, he is so great at being disgustingly cruel. Yeah,
he is. He's unnaturally cruel to these poor girls. And,
yes.
And of course, a little Jane's best friend, Helen Burns, is played by Elizabeth Taylor in one of her first
screen
roles.
How beautiful was Elizabeth? And she, you know, she didn't have much to say, but I thought she was very good. Very touching.
She was, yes. They sort of light her like a little angel, you know. I think she's supposed to be this sort of angelic figure that gives Jane hope in the depths of despair. And they both are forced to march in the rain outside, you know, and she gets sick. In the book, there's a typhus outbreak in the school, and a lot of these kids, these girls are lost, and they're very ill, and they die. It's really tragic. In the book, it's just Elizabeth Taylor's character Helen Burns who dies, but yeah, Jane had kind of a wretched childhood,
and Agnes Moorehead was perfect as her wretched aunt.
Agnes again, yes, she's always plays those roles, and she's always wonderful. She's not afraid to be disliked. Very bold actress. No, it's great. I mean, you know, I'll get your take on it. But I mean, I love this sort of film noir lighting. And noir was just becoming a thing at the time. And it's very gothic, the shadows falling across her face. And when she goes to Thornfield Hall and meets Mr. Rochester, and then it becomes a romance. But yet her entire life, you know, the whole film is plagued by misfortune, really, for Jane. She's a poor orphan, and she just doesn't have an easy time of it. But, you know, she becomes a stronger person through it, and that's what I like.
She sure does. And she eventually, well, I love how she turns down that horrible guy. She grows. How long is she at that horrible place?
At Lowood, she's there 8 years.
Yeah. So she finally, and he thinks he's doing her a favor by making her a teacher there.
Right.
Thanks,
yeah.
Pal.
Oh, I love it when she stands up for herself, right? She's like, why should I be grateful to you? Yes, you took me in and gave me food, but you were horrible. You were mean. You were cruel. Forget it. I'm out of here.
Not enough money in the world, and there wasn't any money anyway. And in the meantime, she was sending letters out trying to get another position. Mm-hmm. And he knew that. And luckily, she was able to find the one she found.
Yes, and it all worked out somehow, but there's more trouble ahead for Jane, always. But she overcomes it by her faith and by her just moral integrity and by staying true to who she is and always trying to better herself and be a good person.
Yes, and I have to say the cast is great. Of course, Orson Welles, he was wonderful in this role, I thought. I thought Joan Fontaine was perfection, and she's not my favorite actress, but I liked her a lot in this. A little FYI for you guys, Edith Barrett plays the housekeeper, and she was Vincent Price's first wife. And she did a lot of character roles, and like in I Walked with a Zombie that Sloan and I were talking about yesterday, she played the mother of Tom Conway.
Oh, right.
And his yeah.
Who's totally hot, full disclosure.
Yes.
Okay.
We're duking it out over him and Dana Andrews.
Dana and Tom are the hotties of the classic film world. Too much information, perhaps, but we're sort of madly in love with them. Okay,
yes.
Moving on.
But it's a great film. She falls in love. Oh, tell the secret of this whole film, because they want to get married. He wants to be in love. And there's this huge secret, this thing that he thinks he can't get rid of, which sort of fits with today's world. You think, oh my God, how are we ever going to get rid of this virus? How are we ever going to? And not comparing this woman to a virus. Mm-hmm. He is trapped. Right.
Well, do we want to give away the secret, though, for people who haven't seen it? Or do we just want to hint at it?
We'll hint at it.
Okay.
He has a secret.
And yes, he has a secret locked away in the attic of the gloomy old house.
And another child actress was Margaret O'Brien there as well. And yes, and Jane falls madly in love with him, and he loves her too. But there is this thing chained in the attic that if let loose, forget it, Charlie. So you will see that, yes, there is this thing. There is this poor thing, disease, whatever you want to call it, that hinders his freedom. And he does escape from it. And that's about all I guess we can tell you, that it's a happy ending. She becomes strong and just the woman she's supposed to be. She's, even though she was treated like crap, she still has compassion and warmth and fairness, right?
Yes, she rises above her circumstances, but partly because that's an important point. Two important points here is to your point. Mr. Rochester has his demons, and he thinks that he can just push them aside because he doesn't know what else to do. Honestly, he has to confront them. You know, he can't ignore them. He has to confront them head on and deal with it. And then Jane. Another point to remember is that she becomes a better person, not just in spite of adversity, but I think because of it, don't you? Because of the deprivation, because
yes,
of, you know, Lowood Institution, the strict
that the horrible
harsh,
aunt.
Restrictions of it, yes, and everything that she has to go through molds her into a better person.
And she could have gone the other way. She could have become right. bitter and hard, but she became the opposite. She became empathetic, but no fool. She became bright, empathetic, mm-hmm. and got to talk about Hillary Brooke, who played that woman who was going to marry Orson Welles.
Oh, yes. Her name is Blanche.
Right. She plays wonderful, snobby creatures. She was in Enchanted Cottage, and she played Robert Young's fiance.
Okay.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Remember mm-hmm. her?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Maid. And then, you know who she played? This is a fun fact, everybody. I Love Lucy, when they went to Europe, they went to England, and Lucy wanted to go to hounds, be invited to some lord's house. And she found out the lord's house had Hillary Brooks in it and said, might I borrow Ricky? She had the hots for Ricky. And that was a funny one. You hated her. You always hated her.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I love those women who played those roles that you love to hate, you know, and they were so good at it.
She was perfect. So she didn't have a big part in this, but I have to give her a shout out because she was very good. Should we go to our second?
Yes. And it's your turn.
Yes.
What was your second or your pick?
We are doing a tree. Actually, you inspired this pick. A Tree mm-hmm. Grows in Brooklyn, starring again the wonderful Peggy Ann Garner. I believe this is 1946, so she's 3 years older.
I think it came out in 45, 46. Yeah. And that was, she's the same actress as Jane Eyre.
Mm-hmm. And she did a wonderful job. And it's about this family, like turn of the century, 1900s, in Brooklyn, Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And they are not a wealthy family by any means. Their father is a singing waiter, and he still says he's going to be discovered. And that's played by, Jesus, I know his name. He's Johnny Nolan, and I love him, James Dunn. James Dunn. And Dorothy McGuire stars as his wife, and she's very hardened because she, you know, has listened to his dreams, his stories, and all she knows is she has to scrub the floors and do extra work so that they have a place to live. And in a lot of ways, you look at her, and even in the way that they show him, you're supposed to dislike her. But you have to go, this poor lady is trying to keep her kids there, and she has hardened. She is hard. But she does have an epiphany. He loves his kids. I love Ted Donaldson plays the other her brother and the son. It's got the greatest Brooklyn accent. Yeah. Neely, do you think I'm pretty? You'll do. You know, he's just so funny.
Yeah.
He's just like the comic relief. And also Joan Blondell, who plays Sissy, who is Miss McGuire's, I guess older or younger. She's her sister.
Her sister. Yeah. I don't know if she's older or younger. Aunt Sissy.
She is great. She's fun. She's been married tons of times. She just has a very great sense of fun, which Dorothy McGuire's character doesn't Last. Really appreciate. She kind of like doesn't yeah. like it. And she gets the kids to borrow neighbor's skates. And then that's it. You know, Dorothy McGuire says, you're out of here. I don't want you coming back. You're terrible. And you can't see my kids again. Anyway, with Johnny, the drunk, and he was, and he would work sporadically. And there would be days he wouldn't come home because he was so drunk and hanging around at taverns. But he loved his kids. He adored his kids. He took time. He read. Francie wanted to be a writer. And she was going to a crappy school. And he found a school for her that was in a better school. He lied and got an address from a nice neighborhood and got her into a better school where she could thrive. And it was just a beautiful story, and her love for her father and her writing. And she used to lie with the teacher. And the teacher said, you know what, Francie, you shouldn't lie, but use that because you have something very important. You have your imagination, which is something we should all have. And people lose. I think even kids today, what kind of imagination do they have when they just look at everything on the computer?
Look at their phone or their computer and everything is there in an instant. Yeah, I do think it tends to stunt the imagination, if not completely deflated.
Yes. And or their imagination is, oh, I want to be like Kylie Jenner, or I want to be like this.
Yeah. But, I want to be a TikTok star.
Right. But you know, like I remember when I was a kid, I'm still a voracious reader. I was a reader. I couldn't get my hands on enough books. And even very young, I was reading classic Hollywood books, even though I didn't really know what classic Hollywood was. But my imagination saved me through my childhood. You know, yes. I didn't have my imagination.
Same here, we had – your parents probably read to you when you were little.
No.
They didn't.
I was the youngest of six. I was like yesterday's news. You know, they read to the first two girls, then my brothers, and then the last two was like an afterthought.
Well, but you received it. You received the reading by osmosis somehow because you were at the end of the chain, I would assume. So that still makes sense. And you gravitated to books on your own.
Yes. And I was like, I'm bragging everybody. And in first grade, they did my aptitude test and I had an eighth grade reading comprehension.
Yeah, same here.
You
too? I don't know if that's the exact – well, I don't think that was tested exactly on that level. I don't remember that. But I'm saying I was always ahead of the pack. I remember being a little first grader, and the kids were stumbling over their words. And I would say, why can't you read better? The teacher had to take me aside. And
oh, you would do that?
Don't criticize others. Everybody's at their own pace. Yes.
I was the opposite of you because I was embarrassed that I – tests.
Oh.
I would wait. I was embarrassed because people were like, oh, Grace, you're so smart. You're so smart. And I was horrified. I was done with my tests. I swear, at least 5 minutes before the next person, I would wait for two people to put their papers on the desk. And then I would get up and put my paper on. But I was like waiting forever, thinking to myself, what is taking them so long? This is so easy.
Yeah.
But I was not a bragger like you, Sloan. I'm sorry.
I was. I admit it. I would brag and I would criticize the other kids. I was a smart-ass little twerp.
And I was just the opposite. But anyway.
But we both loved reading, thank goodness, because reading is an interactive activity. It stimulates your brain and your imagination. It doesn't just present you with something like on a, you know, screen.
Right. And you have to think. And, you know, to me, books were my salvation, just like they were for Francie. Because she would go to the library and she was reading everything, starting at A in the library and said, here, take something home that's fun. Please. It's because she was always reading like stupid stuff. And her father, I guess they had one nice night.
He was at the wedding, when he worked at a wedding.
Oh, yes. And they came home and everything was fun. And she was happy, the mother. And I guess that's the night this happened. She got pregnant again. And things changed, and because you couldn't count on him. And he sang this beautiful song, Annie Laurie. I don't know if that's the name of the song, but it makes me cry every time I hear him sing that song. And it is such a beautiful, beautiful, and the way he sings it breaks your heart. And she likes it. And she said, the wife, and she said, what is it? And he just keeps going louder and sings it, and ignores her. Because earlier she had told him that Francie had to quit school and work, but Neely would be the first one to – the little boy would be the first one to graduate. And he said, why should he graduate? He doesn't like school. She likes school.
Yeah.
And all the time, Francie's listening to this. And I love the Christmas scene where they're getting the Christmas tree, the two kids. They get the big Christmas tree thrown at them. And now it's like, you can't get it. Throw it at us. And they're doing it. And they get the huge Christmas tree. And they have a beautiful Christmas, too, with Sissy and her new husband. She's finally taken Sissy back in the fold. And the cop who comes through, Officer McShane, who comes and brings candy canes.
She's great.
So he knows that his daughter's going to have to quit school. He knows everything's happening. And he's gone for a week. And we're not going to tell you what happens to Johnny, but it's not the greatest. But the wonderful part is that, like the tree that they cut down, Francie grew. Her branches grew. She graduated. And this is a heartbreaker. You want to tell that part when she's at the graduation in her beautiful dress and Sissy, she sees flowers on her desk.
Oh, right. No, you tell it because I'm fuzzy on it. I don't remember what exactly happens.
Well, she goes through graduation and all the girls have flowers and she feels kind of like, but she's wearing a beautiful white dress.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so she goes into a room and she's the classroom and she sees flowers for her. And she's like, I can't be having any flowers. There's no flowers for me. And it's in her father's handwriting. Holy heartbreak. And she hadn't cried since her father died. And Sissy comes in and says, your dad gave me the money. And he wrote the card because he wanted you to graduate. And he wanted to make sure that you would get your flowers. And that is just like devastation. Finally, Francie can cry over the death of her father and kind of be released to love. You know, like when he died, the mother couldn't understand all the people crying at his funeral. And she was like, who'd cry for me? Who'd cry for me? Nobody cares. But why did everybody love him so much? Because he always had a kind word and remembered people and remembered things.
He was a kind man. He was a sensitive man. He was an alcoholic.
Yes. Yeah,
that was his downfall. And he couldn't provide for his family, which is understandably devastating to his wife. But you know, she has a point because she's the one making it. She's the one trying to keep the family together and keep every food on the table and make everything happen by scrubbing floors, you know, but everybody loved him.
And you know
what? Idealized him.
And I, you know, it was not, you know, I don't know why she should have been much more sympathetic, but most people like judged her. Even her sister said, stop being so hard to him. You're so hard. Yeah. You hardened your heart. And she did.
Well, but she had to harden. Dorothy McGuire's character, Katie, the mother, had to harden her heart because she was a young, beautiful girl who could have had probably, you know, many men in the neighborhood. And she fell for him. And she saw her dreams crushed, you know, into a life of poverty, extreme poverty.
And having an alcoholic husband and... Yeah, so, you know, there is sympathy for her, but basically in the movie, they don't make it that way because people judge her because she's hard-hearted, this. But she, you have to understand.
But we know in the end that she has a heart, of course, and she cares.
And she, you know, when she's giving birth to the daughter, Francie's with her. And she said, wouldn't you rather have Neely? He's such a comfort to you, because she thinks that her mother hates her guts. And then her mother starts in her, you know, because they gave birth at home and she's there. And she said, it's not that I never wanted to read your books or whatever, your father, you know. So she read some stuff that she had written. And the mother gave birth to a girl and she called her Annie Laurie. And in the end, everybody's life is going to be easier. We're not going to tell you why.
No, it's a very hopeful ending. And we know that Francie's going to grow up and become a writer. We just feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to get through it. She's going to, again, like Jane Eyre, use her difficult upbringing to become a better person. It brings a tear to my eye.
Yes. And you said you don't cry at movies very often, but her strength through that, and she found it in her. It's just beautiful. And I love the scene on the tree, and they're saying, well, you know, Annie Laurie, she won't have as much fun as us. And that's just it. They were blessed. They loved their father, and they loved what he gave to them through their lives, which was love, imagination, fun, and just unconditional love he gave them. But it's but then it's also the alcoholism and everything else. So, but it is a good movie, and it is hopeful, and it is. It's a wonderful movie. You see changes in almost all the characters, except for her.
Yes, yeah. It's really a slice of life, but it's so much more than that. We should point out this is Ilya Kazan's first directorial
amazing effort. Job. Yes.
Yes, it's really an amazing movie. I think it stands the test of time. I think in 100 years, this movie will be just as relatable, even though it's already set in like the early 1900s. You know, so it's already set in the past when it was released, but it's timeless. You know, it's timeless struggle, and it doesn't shy away from the extreme poverty. I mean, these kids are selling, you know, garbage and rags that they pick up on the street, you know, to
nails,
try to go and get
anything.
A few pennies. Yes. And they bring it to their mom, and she's got her little can that she keeps these little grimy pennies in. You know, this is to buy food and to try to pay their meager rent in their little, you know, rundown apartment. I mean, these people are dirt poor.
And she also, she also has the money for the insurance. She always makes sure.
Yes, right.
Insurance.
The insurance. Yes. That's why she always wants to pay that insurance. But they're just barely scraping by. The kids don't have new clothes. I mean, or anything. They just got shabby shoes, but they're clean and they're educated. They go to school, you know, and that's the important thing. They read books. Anyway, it's really inspiring through difficult times, I think.
I think so too. And they get through them without, and not without loss, and not without sadness. Yes, but they get through it, and they grow, and that's something that's very important for all of us.
So, agreed.
Number three.
So moving on to number three, we're in the money. This is one of my favorites. Talk about putting a smile on your face in the midst of the worst hardship of the Great Depression, Gold Diggers of 1933.
I loved it.
Yes. So fun. And this, you know, we could also talk about 42nd Street, which is sort of the precursor. It's almost like a follow-up to 42nd Street. Both of them are great. But Gold Diggers, to me, is a little more on point with really showing you in a comic, you know, sort of lighthearted way, the depravity of the Great Depression. You know, it's about these showgirls, Trixie, played by Aileen McMahon.
Love her.
And she's so great. And Ruby Keeler and Joan Blondell.
Love her.
And these, yes, fabulous ladies. And Ginger Rogers is in there too as Faye Fortune. I love that. Her character's
yes.
name is Faye Fortune. And she's a little gold digger too. She has a more minor role. This is right before Ginger, you know, became a big star with Fred Astaire and all
right.
that. But yes, I love these Warner Brothers musicals from the early 30s. Directed by Mervyn LeRoy, who was great. Of course, Busby Berkeley choreographed the dance numbers. You know, but in the beginning scenes, they're really struggling. These three girls live together, and they used to be, you know, they're not big stars, but they're talented performers on Broadway, and all the theaters are closed. I love that scene in the beginning where they show you all the theaters
yes.
on Broadway closed down, because nobody can get funds to put a show together. And so Barney, this big producer, you know, comes up with this idea for a show, and they all get excited, but it turns out he doesn't have a dime. He's just sort of talking. And they start out in their apartment, you know, they barely have anything to eat. I mean, they're laughing. They're making jokes about it.
They steal somebody's milk. They
have to steal the neighbor's milk. They get the fireplace, you know, the, what are they called? The little andirons from the fireplace. And they like grab the milk off their neighbor's balcony so they can have milk in the morning. Their furniture's being repossessed. I mean, it's really no joke. They're out of work and they can't pay the rent. I love how everybody's dodging the landlady. Everybody's wearing dark glasses trying to avoid the landlady. In those
Very
days,
Clark
you could do
Kent,
that,
yeah.
right? You wouldn't just get evicted.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't get eviction papers. You just have to avoid the landlady and say, oh, I'll pay you next week. Everybody was doing this. They couldn't pay rent.
Of course
you
not.
Know, that was no joke, but it was, they did it in a very lighthearted, you know, way. And then it's got they finally get the show. Dick Powell's character, the songwriter, you know, starts writing the songs, and it turns out he's secretly a millionaire. He's from this wealthy family. His brother, I don't even know if we need to go into the plot. It's kind of silly, but his brother, you know.
Is that wonderful Warren Williams?
Warren Williams, yes, Mr. Warren Williams, and then Guy Kibbe is his
love Guy
is
Kibbe
his partner
too.
In crime, right?
Does great stuff.
He's hilarious, and so these stuffed shirt kind of Wall Street types, you know, are hypocrites, and they want to pay off this. They want to pay off Ruby Keeler's character to get away from their brother because showgirls are chiselers and parasites, and of course they end up falling for these showgirls. And then they take them for a ride because they deserve it. And they like tap them for everything they've got. They make them buy hats and clothes and take them out on the town. And they put the show on, of course. And anyway, all's well that ends well. And it's got some great numbers. The Forgotten Man number at the
oh
end.
My. Oh, my. Yeah.
Goosebumps.
Goosebumps. Yes.
So it's really a show about the Depression. I mean, it's a movie about the Great Depression and on Broadway. And then their show within a show is about the Great Depression. It's crazy, right?
It is. But it's hopeful. But and like you said, it takes a more comical turn. But this was really what was happening. People were not able to afford their rents. And movies were very cheap. So they for people to go into to see. So this was a way for people to escape their troubles. So these musicals, and this one I would say is not musical. It has more of a story than a music. I think they only have like three
or
four.
It's a backstage musical.
Right.
Yeah, there's some numbers, but it's not like a music. They don't sing. They don't break into song throughout the movie.
Right. It's sort of you get the story of it. And you see these women struggling, and they make it humorous, but it really isn't. I mean, they're starving. They don't know what they're going to do. They have each other as to support each other, you know, in life. But they don't know what's going to happen to them.
And at one point, I love that one scene where Trixie is backstage and Brad, Dick Powell's character, doesn't want to go on because he's afraid he'll be recognized, right? And she gives him a tongue lashing. She says, this is not about you. You better go out there because this show has to go on. Because if it doesn't, these kids who have been rehearsing and starving to death for 6 months of rehearsal
are
going to be out
on
the street.
Everybody.
Yes, without a job. And they may die because of you. I mean, it's no joke.
Which sets in with today that we see what's happening, unemployment, all this stuff. And God knows, we don't know what's going to happen. That's the truth. If someone said to me, Grace, predict what's going to happen next week. I can't. Predict what's going to happen tomorrow. I can't. Predict what's going to happen in 10 minutes.
It's probably not going to be very good for a while.
Yes. But they get through it. Just like the Great Depression, people got through it. But, you know, we have our struggles. And this is a good movie to watch because it's not serious. It's not going to make you want to cry. It's not going to make – you're going to enjoy it. But it has – it's not just some fluff movie either.
No, because of the end scene with Joan Blondell and the Forgotten Man, you know, it's this wonderful haunting number. If you haven't seen the movie, everybody who's listening, you have to go out and see it right now. You can see it online. It's at the end, this haunting song, Remember My Forgotten Man, and they show you these men who fought in World War I, and they were heroes, and they won medals, and they risked their life for their country, and they came back, similar to Vietnam, similar to today, they came back with post-traumatic stress, which didn't have a name then, and all kinds of horrors in their psyche, and they were just, by the time the Depression came along, they were cast aside, they were treated like dirt, they were basically, many of them, homeless, you know, begging on street corners.
And this is how it happened, truly, where we got these hobos, you know, because they would literally get on top of a train or in a train trying to find somewhere that they could maybe get a job, get something. And it was horrible. We weren't around then, and I can't imagine it, but right now I can't even imagine what's happening today. So
well, that's a good lead-in, I think, to the next movie you were going to talk about, maybe with the hobos riding on trains.
Right. We're talking about Sullivan's Travels, which is Preston Sturges, starring one of my favorite underrated actors, Joel McRae, and Veronica Lake. And he plays a director who just thinks he's doing these stupid comedies that are meaningless, and he doesn't know anything about suffering in life because it's depression time then, right? Or when the movie was taking place?
It was released in 1941, but it was, you know, a lot of people forget that the world was not the world, you know, the depression on the heels of the Great Depression was World War II, of course. We know that. And the country was kind of coming out of the Depression, but then there's the dark specter of war in Europe, and we're gearing up to join that war. And it's very dark times still.
Right. So he's like, I know nothing in life. I know nothing. I am sick of these stupid, fluffy movies I'm putting out that make people laugh. And he meets Veronica Lake at a diner. She thinks
Great
he's
scene.
Broke, and she buys him ham and eggs, and she doesn't have any money.
Right.
And then I guess he takes her back to her house, whatever. And she becomes, he said, okay, the only way, I want to make dramas. I want to make great human tragedies. And so he dresses as a hobo. And Veronica Lake says, I'm coming with you. And she's like a mini hobo because she's really tiny.
Yeah.
He's like 6'3".
They're like Laurel and Hardy together. It's so cute.
6'3", and she's about 4'11" at the most. And but they do have like the truck following them at first. They have like, yeah, the van, guys.
Right.
The van. But they get disrupted. He goes back. And then he goes.
He sets out to actually live like a hobo, we should say. Like become a homeless street drifter who with no money in his pocket and shabby clothes and holes in his shoes, who's going to go out and discover what tough life is really like for that crowd.
And Veronica is not with him at this point. He gets beaten up. He loses his memory. And next thing you know, he's charged with murder and he's on a chain gang. Talk about learning about life the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's horrible. I can't even fathom. And I do still think there are chain gangs, but I can't for a moment fathom the cruelty and the suffering these men went through. And the thing was, they were on chain gangs. He was on as suspected murderer, but some of them were on for stealing bread or something like that. Yeah. They're the most minute things.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's there and he doesn't remember who the heck he is. And then he does remember. And it gets
but it's
out
too
there.
Late. He's already at the moment.
Yeah.
Right? He feels like, oh, well, I'm already stuck here in this chain gang.
But he gets the word out and a picture taken and they see him. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, this is what really was his epiphany. Like he wanted to capture the horror of the world, of living for people, the drama, the distress. So, you know, he's on the chain gang, and that's pretty distressful, and it's dramatic, and it's horrifying. But this black church welcomes all the guys in. They have the guy who's playing, the woman who's playing the piano, the pastor, and other people there, and they're going to screen movies for these poor, poor men, black and white, doesn't matter. And he's sitting there, and all of a sudden, I don't know, Donald Duck comes on, or one of the Disney...
It's a Pluto, isn't it, cartoon?
Yeah, Pluto,
yeah,
yes.
And Mickey Mouse.
All of a sudden, everybody starts laughing around him. All the chain gang dudes, you know, and you see their faces beaten, weathered, you know, no teeth, the whole nine yards. And he's looking at this. And then he starts laughing himself. And he realizes, he grows up to see, because he was really childish because he had not suffered. And he thought that that's what he had to show. But then he realized how much laughter people need it, no matter, you know, people are in the direst circumstances, but if they have laughter, they can clear themselves, even if it's just for 10 minutes, an hour, whatever. People need laughter. So he realized he was doing more than he thought he was. And he said, and he didn't want to do the dramas anymore. He learned a humongous lesson. Huge.
Yes. He learned the value of a laugh. And in the end, he says, you know, that's all some people have in life. And it's so true. I mean, today, the past, anytime, doesn't matter what you're going through. If you can't, if something can just bring a laugh, a smile to your face and a chuckle, it sounds corny, but I think it's absolutely true.
Well,
you can get through, you can make it through another day maybe on a laugh.
And I totally believe in it. And I believe a guy wrote it. I believe it was Norman Mailer, and he had cancer, and he said a laugh a day keeps the cancer away or something like that. And he was watching, like, I Love Lucy. He was watching these things, mm-hmm. and he was laughing. I mean, belly laughing every day. And, yeah, we need to laugh. Yes, things are horrible, but we can't be in horror all the time because that's just going to bring us into such a dark, horrible place. And sometimes, you know what? It's not inappropriate to watch something to make us laugh. We don't have to watch Contagion and all these horrible movies, which you were mentioning, Sloan, that are doing very well. You know, I don't know why people want to watch Doom movies, but they do.
I know. People want to make it worse by watching Outbreak, and no thank you. I'll take some of those problems.
Me too. And you know, it's a social commentary, and it's a comedy, yet it's poignant and it's also very sad, but it'll make you laugh. And Preston Sturges was the master at doing things like that. So,
he was wonderful. Yeah, I love all-time favorite, really, filmmaker from that era, Preston Sturges, because he had that touch of genius of, you know, he could bring, like Chaplin, I guess, you know, he could make you smile and cry kind of equally with equal dexterity. But he was very subtle, Sturges, you know, and he had a great ear for dialogue. And another thing about this movie we should point out that makes it so delightful is that Veronica Lake was a newcomer. She was 19 when she first started acting in pictures. She was she was 19 here. 19 years old, and she had just become a big star, or not a big star yet. I guess she was an up-and-coming star, or she's kind of an overnight sensation because there was just no one else like her with that hair over one eye and the whole look and everything. But she was kind of a starlet, and she had been known for doing This Gun for Hire with Alan Ladd, which is very dark noir, of course, and mystery, and she's very serious, you know. So people didn't think she could do comedy. Preston Sturges saw her, and he met her, and he said, I don't know what he said, but he obviously felt she could do comedy, and she wanted us to do comedy, and he believed in her. And I think that it pays off. I think she's so she has this great understated comedic flair that is like that.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
the
definitely not
the
over
smart
the top.
Ass.
Yeah.
No, she's very cool with her little smart ass lines, and she just delivers it perfectly, you know, with such finesse for a 19-year-old with no comedy training. I think she's amazing. I think people need to I would like for her to be more recognized, you know, than she is for her comedy skills. But I think that they're together, they make a great team too with Joel McRae.
He did not like her. This is a true fact.
A lot of people didn't like her.
No,
she was
they
difficult.
Did not like her at all. Her husband didn't like her. Her kids didn't like her. So I think that's why she wasn't propped up as much. And I told this sad story. I read this in Sue Cameron's book. When Veronica was spotted again, she was going to get a star. And she asked Sue to come there. And the only person that was there, she had just met Sue the day before. And Gary Owen, who was like a DJ or something, nobody else was there. And she left before the ceremony was over, probably to get drunk. She had a horrible, but we can't take away the fact that she was good.
That's a whole other episode we can talk about, because the thing about Veronica Lake is that she was not treated well as a child. Let's just say there was abuse going on of various kinds that has not really come out fully, that may never come out fully. Mm-hmm. She had a stage mother who was overbearing, and she developed an alcohol problem at a young age. She was really bad alcoholic. I see her as a victim of the system in many ways. I don't know. Obviously, I never met her personally, but I know that she was a difficult person. And I know she had a difficult childhood, and she was very young when she was thrust into it. So,
I'm not trying to judge her. I'm just giving the other point of view that Joel McRae didn't like her. Also, she was 6 months pregnant. Did you know that?
Yes.
We forgot to tell that little tidbit. Yeah.
Because she wanted this part so much and wanted to work with Preston Sturges so much that she got the role and she found out she was pregnant and she didn't tell her director and she started shooting anyway. He was not happy about that. But you know what? It all worked out in the end. We have this beautiful movie, and I'm so glad it came together.
It was, and I can watch it over and over again. I love this movie very much. But again, I used to be, I guess I'm getting older and I'm not like, 80, 70, 60, 59, 54, 53. I'm not that old. Let's put it that way. But as I get older, I'm old enough. But as I get older, I don't know. I have a hard time watching certain movies, even this one. Because I take it more to heart, kind of get like that.
Yeah, and it's really, but it has a great tonal shift. I mean, because it starts out, it's really a comedy for the first half. And then boom, when he gets caught
hobo
train yard.
Misidentification.
Yeah. Exactly. Boom. Suddenly it's just stops being funny in about a second. And anyway, it's an amazing film.
It really
is.
It's
very inspiring, though. Very inspiring with its laughter and its tears and all the ups and downs. It's more laughter than tears in the end.
And as we were saying, there is no – when people have hardship, it doesn't mean you have to not laugh or see something that's going to make you feel good. Because we need it. I think we need it more than anything at this kind of time.
Agreed.
Okay, so you're on, Toots.
Okay, next movie to watch that is inspiring to overcome hardship would be Babyface from 1933.
Love
now,
it.
This is... Oh, and I should mention, like Jane Eyre, this is... one of the 50 dynamic dames in my book from Turner Classic Movies
that
just came out this summer. Yes, thank you. Dynamic Dames, 50 leading ladies who made history, and it's throughout the history of cinema. It's some of the strongest female leading roles and the actresses who brought them to life. And this is one of my favorites, Barbara Stanwyck as Lily Powers in Babyface. And this is a pre-code most people have probably heard of if they haven't seen, because it's kind of notorious as one of the most
pre-code. It is.
It's really pre-code. And it's even the censored version. Okay, this is the censored version that we've usually been watching all these years. And that alone is outrageous because it's about this woman who starts out, man, she's got it rough too. Another girl with a rough upbringing here. She works in, the outskirts of Pittsburgh, in her father's tavern. And he's abusive and he's drunk and he's slobby and he's horrible. And she has to put up with all his abusive, drunk, slobby, horrible men, patrons of this bar that she works in. And they're always grabbing her, their grabby hands, and they're sweaty, and she's
disgusting.
Having to fight them off.
Yeah.
And her dad basically, it's hinted, if not really shown, that he kind of pimps her out, basically.
Since she was 14 years old.
Since she was 14, he starts pimping her out to make some extra cash on the side. It's awful. It's
disgusting.
Just awful.
And her only friend is Chico.
Chico, the wonderful Teresa Harris, the
who
black
I
actress
love,
who was,
love, love.
Yes, she's beautiful. She could sing. She could dance. She's so talented. And she usually ended up, sadly, in a very racist Hollywood era, playing domestics and maids. And she didn't. She sometimes just had a few lines. She wasn't even credited. But she's great in everything she does. And she. This is one of her best roles, I think.
I agree.
It's really juicy, right? Because she's not. She's sort of the maid. But
she's like her best friend. Their best.
She's a friend, yeah.
Because you know he pimped her out as well. Let's face it.
Oh, right. You can tell. You can just tell. She's not. Neither one of them are treated any better. Even though you know Chico's black and Lily's white. But I mean, they're both given the raw end of the deal on every turn. And they stick together. They band together. And when. You know, they leave together. Her father, unfortunately, sadly dies in a horrible fire. Boo-hoo.
Boo-hoo.
And they're real broken up about it, let me tell you. And they hop a train. And I won't even, you know, let's just say that every step of the way, and the movie makes it very clear.
And funny.
Lily is in funny about it. She is using sex to get ahead in the world because it's all she has. And we should back up and say
about
that,
the Nietzsche guy.
Mr. Craig. Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Craig is a philosopher and he has her read Nietzsche. And this movie gets very deep in many ways. I mean, it really thinks about what it's doing. It's not just a sensationalistic, you know, like sexcapade.
No,
I
not
mean,
at
it
all.
Really is thoughtful. And in fact, we should also point out that Barbara Stanwyck worked on the screenplay with Daryl Zanuck.
I didn't know that.
So she worked on the idea. She came up with the concept with Daryl Zanuck, and then Catherine Scola co-wrote the screenplay with Jean Markey. So it was co-conceived by this woman who played the lead role, Barbara Stanwyck, and
who I adore, one of my favorite actresses.
Yes. Fabulous actress, wonderful Barbara Stanwyck, and she's so great. I mean, we'll talk about it later. I know there's a part that you want to talk about that you love in the beginning that she does. But we should point out Mr. Craig is he's kind of her mentor, and he said, you know, she's this young, beautiful woman who's very hardened by what she's been through, and she's uneducated, and she says, "What can I do in the world?" He's trying to inspire her to, you know, look, your father's gone. You're in the world alone now. Go out and make something of yourself. And she's like, well, what can I do? I'm a woman. You know, I have no education. I'm young. And he says, you're beautiful. Use it. Use your sex appeal because that's all you have. And you make men your slaves. You don't become their slave. You
use
turn the tables on them.
Use yeah. them. Don't let you be used.
Yes, he says, I have it actually right here written in the book, you must use men, not let them use you. You must be a master, not a slave. Use men to get the things you want, he tells her, right? This is the uncensored version, the original version. Now, they went back later and changed some things, which we'll get into in a minute, but the overall plot is, you know, she does what he says. She uses her sex appeal at this job she gets in an office, and she keeps working her way up to the top by sleeping with these men. And her outfits get better, her hairdos get better, she gets more sophisticated. And, you know, sadly,
better apartments,
this is all,
that's for sure.
Her apartments get better, and Chico flourishes right alongside of her. I mean, she shares, you know, Chico looks glammed out.
Yeah, I mean, even though she's her maid,
stones and furs,
she's not really, you know, she's just there,
right.
And she has these beautiful clothes, and she's just mm-hmm. her pal, you know, that's it.
Yeah, and they really have an equal kind of partnership.
Very
even though
much
she's
so.
Quote unquote the maid. It's very unusual for the day. This black woman and this white woman being kind of equal partners in this scheme to use men and you can vilify her, which is what the censored version does. It kind of turns her into the villain. But the truth is that this is what her father taught her. This is all the world she lived in the sexist, awful world of the Depression era when, you know, the opportunities for women were so few. And the money was so hard to come by, and the men usually had it all. or they did have it all. You know, this was all she knew. But in her defense, she also betters herself. She reads books on grammar. She learns her profession really well. She excels in her profession. So she's really bettering herself. She's not just relying on sex alone to
and
get
she
ahead.
But continues to work, you know, until
she's a hard worker.
Yes.
She just sleeps with a few men to get there. And she ends up, you know, getting more and more money. She gets richer and richer men. And she has this suitcase full of cash. I mean, she's kind of a baller, you know, toward the end. And she's been saving her money. She doesn't save it in a bank. She probably doesn't trust banks.
The
Great Depression, right? And she's becoming her own financially independent woman. She says, you know what's in this suitcase? $500,000. Someday I'm going to have the other half that goes with it. I mean, she is ambitious. You got to give her that. But she falls in love
with George Brent,
who wouldn't? And so we won't tell you what happens in the end. But she, you know, watch the uncensored version if you can.
Oh, I think that's the one they play now. I think
that's the one
they do.
No, you're right. That's more common, thankfully, as it should be.
Yeah.
Because the censored version is awful. They punish her more in the end. They make it, they change Mr. Cragg's advice to say, don't take the wrong path. Take the virtuous path.
Yeah,
he said, you
misunderstood what I was saying.
Yes.
He gives her like
and
this
then
harsh
he writes her a nasty
crap.
Letter
yeah.
saying that she misunderstood and she's going to burn in hell or whatever.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it places all the blame on her shoulders when really she's a victim of her environment and she's doing the best that she can. And she's an amazingly rich, interesting character. And she breaks every rule for women. I mean, she breaks every rule that women are not supposed to do. And yet the audience still is on her side. We root for her.
We do. And like I said, when my mother was dying, I was fortunate to spend a lot of time with her in Massachusetts. And one day we both love TCM. And one day Babyface was on and she's sitting down next to me. And as it's going on, my mother's giggling through the whole thing. She loves the whole movie where everybody's like, oh, she's supposed to be a pulp. My mother laughed. She adored it. She thought Barbara Stanwyck was wonderful. And she just laughed and just got so much joy out of Babyface.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, I know. I was so happy she liked it. She just loved it so much. One of the things they do have in it, which I have never seen, this shocked me, and a scene, let's say a murder scene that you didn't see. And Lily never murdered anybody. And all she did was sort of use men, you know, and worked her way through the top, literally, of the building. And I love how she starts at the bottom. He says, mm-hmm. Do you have experience? You bet I do. She
plenty,
rolls her eyes.
Brother, plenty, yeah.
But she is always faithful to her friend, Chico. Mm-hmm. Wherever she goes, Chico goes. And remember, richest patron, he said, I can't stand her. Can't you get rid of her? And she says, Chico stays. She does the same thing that she did when her father said, when she dropped something,
mm-hmm.
she said, if Chico goes, I go. So she was very, her loyalty was to her friend, which was really, I thought, admirable. How much.
Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen to Chico if she's put out on the street? She'd fare even worse than Lily. So
right.
She's really looking out for her.
Yes. And Lily ends up marrying George and it's this whole thing. Anyway, after this big scandal happens, she's trying to prove to George that she's not, I don't know why she did that. France, right? But she goes to France and proves herself that she's a really good worker. And,
right.
you know, she's not working her way through anything. And George comes and then falls madly in love with her. And she said, I want a Mrs. in front of my gravestone. And they get married. And it's interesting. If you see both endings, like one ending is like, what? And then the other ending is like, hmm.
Well, the phony tacked on, you know, there's that phony, I don't even think we should tell what it is, but you'll see there's like phony tacked on stock footage, you know, at the end. And then it's really clumsy the way the Hayes office made them edit it. And I'm so glad that, you know, that was the only version though the world had seen until 2004 when the original cut was discovered in a vault. and screened. And they were like, holy cow, this is a whole different movie. I'm so glad that that original print was not destroyed. And think about it.
What they cut out was like only 4 minutes. And how it changed the movie is amazing.
The changes are huge, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, the train thing, I was like, whoa.
I know.
That was amazing
That's
to me.
That's harsh. That is like in your face. Right. Really.
And she's singing.
Even today.
Oh, poof. And Chico's singing throughout it. She sings St. Louis Blues. Or na-na-na-na. That's a whole theme of Babyface. And it's just a good film. And as far as it relating to today, tell us.
Well, I think these aren't so much films that necessarily specifically relate to what we're going through as people surviving hard times. I mean, it relates to the way gold diggers did, you know, the horrors of the Depression and what everyone was struggling as so many people were out of work, just like they are all of a sudden now. I mean, you know, we've been through all of this before. We've been through a pandemic with the awful 1918 influenza. We've been through mass unemployment with the Depression.
The war was going on during the 1918 influenza. World War One.
Oh, yes, exactly. That's how it started in the barracks. And, this is what classic film in the trenches, this is what classic film teaches us. It is, I think it's a great history lesson. It shows you that people made it through hard times. And yes, these are movies, but they were reflecting the actualities of their era. They didn't take place in a rosy world of their own.
No, not
with
rose colored
glasses. This movie's
very
hard hitting. Yeah, the Babyface is very hard hitting. It's about a woman who makes it through, you know, hell.
She makes it through sex and she hates it. That's hell for her because it's hell. I'm working harder than I ever did, meaning she has to. She has no sex with these people.
And some of them are not attractive, let me tell you.
Well, I think she's repulsed by the whole fact that that's what she has to do. And I don't think she would have found any of them attractive because it was hard work.
Right.
Especially Fuzzy Wuzzy.
Yeah. No, she was not into him or any of them. I don't think she had been in love with a man until George Brent came along. And that was real.
Yes.
You know, so it
And it scared her in many ways. It scared her in many ways.
I think she was afraid of it, but she did, I think she has a character arc and she does change in the end, but I don't think that she should be punished because she's doing what she has to do.
I don't either. That's what she learned. You know, my goodness, how can you, if we were 14 and went through all the stuff this poor girl went through, who are we to judge anything? So, and along the way, it's also just a really good movie. You know?
It's really entertaining. I mean, I have never met anyone who doesn't love Babyface. You can't stop watching it.
I would faint if somebody didn't like it. Yeah. I would.
So, never met such a person.
Yeah, it's just really a wonderful film. Like I said, my mother loved it. And she did giggle because she thought it was funny the way she worked her way at the top and with all those people. And
it's funny. It's not trying to be deathly serious about it, but it's, again, it's hard hitting in some areas.
Yeah.
It's raw.
Oh, she loved all of it and she got the whole point, but then she found the humor in it too. That, you know, you wouldn't think somebody would, but you know, that was whatever. It's a great movie. I would just tell anybody to watch it. It is great.
I would agree.